give you a chance to ask me questions. I would like to know if anyone answered this question about the marginality of the force term interaction. Yes? So can you just say in words why? Okay. Okay, that's very good. Yes, the reason I think it's important that you guys become very good at this kind of thing, because when you see an interaction, you should have an immediate intuition whether this interaction is important at low energies or at high energies. And the way to do it is by counting what the dimension of the operator is. Okay, so now we can proceed. So was there any question about yesterday? I'll kind of go over again the n=4. I know it was a little bit traumatic, but is there anything else other than n=4? Okay, so let me just maybe review a little bit the logic of what we're trying to do. We're trying to identify the large and dual of four-dimensional gate series in the larger limit. And I took the approach of saying that usually we can say more things about theories that have lots of symmetries. So we try to construct a theory that has lots of symmetry. We started first by making the theory conformal. And we saw that that's closely connected. To the necessity of the running of the coupling to be trivial, namely that the beta function of the theory vanishes, which is very rare in most, if you write a random field theory, quantum effects will make the coupling run. Then I motivated that you can arrive at this cancellation between various ultraviolet divergences or short distance properties arising from bosons and fermions, which roughly speaking contribute oppositely. And then we saw there is a theory which exactly has the property that it relates the couplings of bosons to the couplings of fermions and also pairs up the bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom, which was supersymmetry. Okay? So then one can try to study the representation theory of supersymmetry, which we don't have time to do right now. But it is something that it's well known and it's standard and you can read in textbooks. I mean, I explained to some of you yesterday afternoon what I'm going to claim now. So now that you have a theory that's conformal and supersymmetric, you can try to write down how much of supersymmetry can a gauge theory possibly have. And this is the thing that I explained to some of you yesterday, but for the time being, just believe me, or I can explain it outside the class if necessary. So the theory that has maximal amount of supersymmetry in four dimensions contains 16 supersymmetries. That has to do with the fact that if you had any more, you would start creating multiplets, or you would have fields in your Lagrangian that have spin bigger than one. And those, by our definition, those are not gauge theories. You can have a theory, for example, with 32 supersymmetries, but that would give rise to gravity. In fact, the supergravities of string theory are exactly of the type that have 32 supercharges. But those are not gauge theories. We're doing gauge theories. So then that leads us immediately to this very special, unique theory in four dimensions, which is n=4 super Young Mills. This is the simplest possible theory that you could ever hope to write down in four dimensions. It's kind of the Ising model for four-dimensional gauge theories, field theories. As I said, this is the maximally symmetric gauge theory in four dimensions. It's invariant under, okay, so let's review. So it's invariant under the conformal group, which we already explained last time. The generator of the conformal group can be massaged into a big metric that generates the SO2,4 symmetry algebra. Then we have the 16 supersymmetries. okay? So you get, when you have both conformal and supersymmetry, we call the superconformal theory. Okay, and then I proceeded to write down the Lagrangian of the theory. And a priori, maybe the field content of the theory looks a bit random, but it's an immediate consequence of these two basic facts. One, that the maximal amount of supersymmetry that a gauge theory can have has 16 supercharges. That's related to the fact that you have 16 fermions in the theory. So now we have to add degrees of freedom in such a way that they have exactly the same number of bosonic degrees of freedom as a 16 component fermion would have, okay? So a 16 component fermion, 16 fermions, these lambda alphas, there are 16 of them, but the equations of motion relates half the component with the other half, so you have eight bosonic degrees of freedom. Since we're talking about gauge theories, you obviously have to have a gauge field, because that's what a gauge theory is. And a gauge field in four dimensions has 2 degrees of freedom. So in order to compensate the difference between the fermionic degrees of freedom from the gaugeino, or gluino, or this fermion, and the degrees of freedom of the gauge field, we have to compensate by adding some other degrees of freedom, 6, which correspond to 6 scalar fields. So this I runs from 1 to 6.
Alpha runs from 1 to 16.
Alpha runs from 1 to 16. No, so it has 16 components, but if you count degrees of freedom, you have to look at the equations of motion, and you find that 8 of the components are related to the other 8 by the Dirac equation. So now you can go ahead and write down the Lagrangian of the theory. There is a very elegant way of writing it that makes manifest some of these things. If you start with 10 dimensions, which I explained to some of you yesterday, I can explain it again if people want, but outside the lecture. And essentially, what you get is a Lagrangian. So first of all, the thing that's important is that these 3 degrees of freedom transform in exactly the same way. So all of them are n by n Hermitian matrices. And essentially, what I write here is the kinetic terms for all of them. So the kinetic term for the gauge field, for the scalars, and for the fermions. And on top of that, I can add Higgs potential, which is this guy. And I can add a Yukawa term. Okay. And as I was saying, in four dimensions, you always have the freedom of adding this, what's called the topological term, to the four-dimensional theory. And this is the Lagrangian of n equals 4. And if you can go ahead with some effort and actually construct the conserved currents associated to both the conformal symmetries and the supersymmetries, okay? And this is the most symmetric theory that you can have. So this is the symmetry that we're talking about so far. It turns out that there is another symmetry. As you can, it's pretty obvious from this point of view. You have 6 scalars, and all the indices I are contracted with each other. So that means that we have an extra symmetry. So can someone tell me what the symmetry would be? So how would you quantify that? Sorry? That's SO6, because I mean, if I perform a rotation, phi I, phi j, this obviously leaves invariant phi I, phi I, if R is an orthogonal matrix. And since I have 6 fields, it's a 6 by 6 matrix. So that means that apart from SO2,4 and the supersymmetries, I also have an SO6 global symmetry. Okay, yeah, SO6 symmetry, doesn't matter. So in total, we have the conformal symmetry, we have the flavor symmetry, and we have 16 supersymmetries. It turns out that apart from supersymmetries, that apart from the 16 supersymmetries, there are another type of supersymmetries that are kind of partners. So remember that the conformal group had Poincaré, which contains translations, and also had special conformal transformations, which we call K-mu. The supersymmetries that I've been discussing, and the ones that are usually discussed, are the ones that have the property that if you make two supersymmetry transformations, you generate a translation, okay? And these are what are called the Poincaré supersymmetries. So these are supersymmetries that have the property that if you look at the transformation generated by two consecutive transformations, you get a translation. It turns out that once you have supersymmetry, this type of supersymmetry combined with conformal symmetry, you automatically get kind of the analog of this equation. You get a new set of supersymmetric transformations S alpha that have the property that instead of closing into translations, they close into the special conformal transformations. Okay? And that's a consequence of having both conformal symmetry and Poincaré supersymmetry. Okay? So in fact, it means that you have 16 supersymmetries plus another 16. So in total, you have 32. But the 16 and 16 have very different nature. Yes? What do they do? So you know what the KMs do, complicated things. So these is alphas, if you represent them in terms of how they act on fields, it's complicated. They will act not homogeneously, like, say, translations do, but will have x-dependent factors. But the way you should think about it is that, okay, maybe another way of saying it is that, how can you generate this guy? The way you can generate it is that you have a Poincaré symmetry plus the usual Qs, you can ask, what is the commutator of a special conformal transformation that you have in the conformal group with the Poincaré supersymmetries, okay? And when you do this commutator, you precisely generate this guy. So you get gamma mu alpha beta S beta. So these are literally the super partners of the Poincaré supersymmetries and their conformal transformations. But they're not going to be terribly important for us right now. Now, this theory has an interesting set of vacua or minima in the potential. This theory has a potential, which is this one, right? And usually, when you have a field theory, you have to expand around the minimum of the potential. So that means that you have to look at this equation, and remember that the only term that is a potential term is this one. And it's easy to convince yourself that if you do the variation of this with this, you get a zero vacuum, a minimum of the potential if the commutator of two fields vanishes for all I and j from 1 to 6. So that means that since you have a set of 6 matrices that are commuting, you can simultaneously diagonalize them. So that means that the ground states, or vacua, are labeled by a diagonal matrix with entries like that. If you have a n by n matrix. Okay. So you have, in fact, a continuous number of vacua. So usually when you study a fixed potential in the standard model, there are essentially 2 vacua. It's a double hat potential. Here you have a continuous space of ground states parameterized by these. So you have how many parameters do you have to specify to give a vacuum state? You have I goes from 1 to 6. Each matrix, each scalar field has n diagonal entries. So it means that you have, in order to specify a vacuum, you have to give 6n real parameters. Okay? There is one vacuum which is special, which is the vacuum where all files equal zero. So can someone tell me what's special from the point of view of these symmetries, in particular the conformal symmetry about phi equals zero? Backing? Yes.
So once you fixed like the eigenvalues of the phi in the ground state, if you conjugate with like a orthogonal transformation, you get a new ground state. So do you?
Yeah, no. So do you strictly speaking,
the same because they differ only by a gauge transformation, or
you should identify them. So the precise statement is that if you do any permutation of the eigenvalue, that's equivalent. Any two matrices that are equivalent after permutation of the eigenvalues is the same.
I'm not just talking about permutating the eigenvalues, but like if you have all of the phi are simultaneously diagonal, so if you change your basis so that they're simultaneously diagonal and now in a different basis, it's...
No, that's a good question. So the inequivalent, so I don't want to say that because it would sound fancy, but the inequivalent space of ground state is you take R6, because you have six fields, to the power n, because you have n of them, n eigenvalues, right? But now you identify this by the action of the permutation group, which arbitrarily rotates the eigenvalues. And this is the set of inequivalent vacuum. Everything else is a Gates equivalent. This is the Gates inequivalent vacuum. OK, so no one answered this yet. So what's special about phi equals zero? So by this, I mean, of course, the expectation value phi equals zero. Say it another way, what happens if I look at this theory around a ground state where the expectation value of phi I is different from zero? You get masses. So, I mean, you have the Higgs mechanism. Yes, but from the point of view of this language, if you give a mass, it means that the theory is no longer conformal. So this state breaks conformal symmetry. Well, this one is conformal invariant. And this is the unique conformal invariant ground state of the theory. Even though the theory has many of them, only one of them is conformal invariant. But these are as good as this one. It's just that you break some symmetries. I mean, you're used to having a Lagrangian with a symmetry that is spontaneously broken by the choice of a ground state. So this is an example like this, where the conformal symmetry is broken. Okay. So now we're getting some intuition about n equals 4. Now let me briefly mention a connection. This you will hear more about, I believe, in the third week of lectures, when we will connect a little bit more all this ADS-CFT story with D-brains in string theory. But let me just mention that precisely this Lagrangian describes the low energy. And at some level, I know the Beckers told you, but low energy fluctuations of n coincident DC brains in 10-dimensional flat space. Okay? So by this, I mean that if you look at a stack of n D3 brains, these are defects that have 3+1 dimensions in space-time. And now you consider, so these objects are in a theory of gravity, so they have their own dynamics. And remember that in order to describe the dynamics of a D-brain, you have to look at the open strings that end on the D-brain. And now you have many types of open strings, because an open string, even though I'm writing them as separated here, you should think of the n d-brains really as being on top of each other. So you had open strings that goes, for example, between brain 1 and brain 1. But you can also have an open string that goes between brain 1 and brain 2. And this exactly generates for you the IJ component of the Gates field. where I corresponds to which brain did the OpenString begin in, and J corresponds to which OpenString the OpenString ended on, which the brain the OpenString ended on. So that motivates the gauge field. In order to motivate the scalars, you have to think how many, in order to tell you to specify the position of the D-brain in 10 dimensions, of a D3-brain in 10 dimensions, how many coordinates do I have to fix? If you have a particle in four space-time dimensions, how many coordinates, special coordinates, do you have to give me in order to specify the location?
Three.
So, okay, so what would be the answer for this?
Six.
Sorry?
Six.
Six, precisely. You have six transverse directions to the three brains. You have to tell me in where in those coordinates, where in those dimensions that the brain, the D-brain is sitting. And this precisely corresponds to the scalar field. The eigenvalues of the scalar fields of these metrics, you should really think of as the location of the brain in the six transverse directions. Okay? The reason I'm mentioning this is that the step that allowed Maldacena to go from the general story of large N being dual to strings to a specific realization was via the physics of D-brains by kind of studying from various points of view what is the dynamics of D3-brains in string theory, which, again, in the third week, you will hear more about. But right now, I just want to go directly to the correspondence that follows from doing this analysis and see that it's incredibly reasonable. So this is the ADS-EFT conjecture for n equals 4 Young-Mills. And I'm doing it for n equals 4 Young-Mills, but you should know that there is an infinite number of pairs of four-dimensional gauge theories being dual to various string theories. So the statement is that un n equals 4 super Young-Mills, exactly this one, is supposed to be completely equivalent to type, okay. Maybe if you don't know what type 2B is, don't worry too much about it, but a type of string theory but not the type of string theory that you've probably seen in the course, which is in 10-dimensional flat space, but string theory in a non-trivial curved background, which is it's called ADS5 and S5, which is just a statement that this is five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, which I'll explain a little bit more what it is, times a phi sphere. So you all know what the sphere is. So the statement is that string theory in this solution of string theory captures everything about n equals 4 super Young-Mills and vice versa. That in some sense, un n equals 4 super Young-Mills knows everything about quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space. To be more precisely, this should be really be called asymptotically, and you'll see why, anti-de Sitter space, okay? So before telling you more specifically what anti-de Sitter space is, if you make a correspondence like that, the first thing that you have to match are the parameters of the correspondence. So n equals 4 Young-Mills has, we have two parameters in it, right? We have the gauge coupling, and we have, if you wish, you have lambda, and we have n. Remember that this is the gauge coupling, this was the tooth coupling, and this is the rank of the gauge group. These things get identified with now data that you need to specify in the string theory. So the gauge coupling constant corresponds to the string coupling constant, Remember, this is the coupling that measures the splitting and joining interaction of strings. The toothed coupling corresponds to the following. This ADS5 times S5, in particular S5, which you have an intuition about, has a certain radius. Because S5, you represent so L is the radius of the sphere. So lambda, and this is the data that characterizes the geometry in which the strings are propagating. So lambda corresponds to taking the fourth power of this radius divided by the string length to the fourth power. Remember that the string length is essentially the characteristic length scale of the string. And N corresponds to the radius of the sphere, but not measured in string units, but measured in terms of Planck units. In string theory, you have two different length scales. One is the string scale that has to do with the size of the string. And then you have the Planck length, which is the length scale associated to the gravitational action. Okay? Did you see in the course the relation between L string and L Planck? No? Okay. I'm wondering if I should do it now or maybe later. For time being, let me postpone this and we'll do it later. But essentially, you have to remember that in string theory, I mean, L Planck, you know what it is? It is the thing that multiplies. So when you have a gravitational action, Einstein gravity, this is Newton's constant. And from Newton's constant, in the dimensions, you can extract the Planck length. That's the definition of the Planck length. Okay, so let's see if I can do this right. So in D special dimensions, well, you can do it. In D special dimensions, what is the dimension of G? Sorry? Length, mass, whatever you want.
So, I don't think it's
a that's a complicated way. There's a simpler way of doing it. Well, hopefully. Yeah. Again, looking at the Lagrangian. Okay, what is the mass dimension or length dimension of the four-dimensional Planck of the four-dimensional Newton's constant?
-1.
No. Well, minus, what does minus mean? Tell me, length square or mass square?
Oh, length square.
Yes. But okay, why? So this would be important. Right? So of course, there are, you might put some number 16 pi, whatever. Well, the reason is that what is this thing? This is the Ricci scalar. The Ricci scalar is constructed out of a metric by taking two derivatives. If you remember, it's constructed from the Christoffel symbol, and those guys have, and then the derivative of the Christoffel symbol. So you have in total two derivatives. Two derivatives means one over length squared. This has units of length to the d. So this guy has to have units of length to the d minus 2. So in the dimension, Newton's constant has dimensions of d minus. So this is what defines for you the Planck length in any theory of gravity. In string theory, on top of that, we have the string length, which is the size of the string. So we see that the three parameters of Yang-Mills theory, in a way, two are only independent in this language. correspond to measuring the curvature, the radius of the sphere in different units, either in the string unit or the Planck length units. Any questions? Is this clear? Yes.
Lambda and lambda.
Well, remember that lambda is something that appears when you study the theory in the two string. So lambda, so when you study the theory in the two string, we're taking the theory in the limit that n goes to infinity.
Oh.
This square goes to zero, sir?
Yeah.
And this was kind of this square n. Okay? Yes?
So didn't we say last time that, when we had the expansion with all the forces and everything, that the G string was 1 over n?
Yes. G string is 1 over n in the large n limit. So even though we were studying the theory, we're motivating the correspondence between string theory, between Gitz theory and string theory by studying the theory in the tooth limit. You might ask whether this correspondence between Gitz theory and string theory holds also beyond the large n limit. And then the correspondence will be like this. G square goes like G string. Now imagine we study the theory in the tooth limit. Then I have to rescale in order for this to be fixed in the n goes to infinity limit. G square has to scale like 1 over n. That, so that tells you that G string is scheduled like 1 over n. Okay, so this is a statement about the parameters. So you see that for any parameter that you can write down here, there's at least a sensible set of parameters of the corresponding string theory. What is the more precise statement of the correspondence? I mean, we don't want to match parameters. We want to compute observables. So the conjecture is that for any observable in the Gitz theory, there is a corresponding one in the string theory, and vice versa. So let me give you some examples of what do I mean by this. So the first thing that you might want to compare is the spectrum of the two theories. That's the simplest thing that you can try to compute. And that more concretely means that for any operator, for any local operator in the conformal field theory, which label O delta of X, so these are operators that are sitting at one space-time point in the four-dimensional Gitz theory. And just to give you some examples what these things are that we kind of already saw. So an example would be, for example, if I take that Lagrangian, I can construct local observables by multiplying any number of these fields together in a way that the operator is Gitz invariant. So you could take the product of, say, of a whole bunch of scalar fields. That would be a local Gitz invariant observable. And for each guy that we write here, we have to construct a corresponding mode in the string theory in ADS5 and ADS5 that corresponds to it. So that would be one type of operator. Note that this operator, since it transforms, remember that this index I was an index that was acted on by the SO6 rotational symmetry that acts on the scalars. So this guy will have a non-trivial quantum numbers under SO6. So that will mean that the corresponding state will have to, okay, I'm anticipating myself a little bit, but we'll have to know about the dynamics of the string on the phi sphere. Another type of operator you can write down that would have other types of quantum numbers would be this one. So you can take the trace of phi I, and here you can act with arbitrary number of covariant derivatives. And I choose plus. By plus, I mean the light cone direction. So you, if you have a four-dimensional space-time, you can always choose light cone coordinates. The reason I write it like this is then it makes it obvious that this operator transforms nicely under a longitudinal boost. So this guy carries a well-defined spin in our four-dimensional field theory. So these are just, there are many, many more operators that you can write down, but this is an example of the type of observables that the duality, I mean, this thing is called a duality, tells you that there should be a corresponding counterpart in the string theory. And the statement is that for these guys, for every operator O delta, there should be a bulk, and or bulk field. Remember that in the first lecture I was saying that the correspondence, you should think of it as a theory living inside a cylinder, and we'll see why, and a theory living at the boundary. And the string theory lives in the bulk of the cylinder, so we would have a bulk field phi delta that propagates in ADS5 that has a mass. So if I tell you what the conformal dimension of the operator is, the corresponding bulk field should have a mass given by this formula, very specific formula. So for every operator of dimension delta, there should be a corresponding bulk field with mass square delta times delta minus 4. So I'll try to explain it later. So right now I'm just making statements. Okay. So apart from these local operators, we can have also other interesting operators, which in fact, in the second lecture today, we're going to heavily use, which are non-local operators. And for those, there's also a corresponding statement. If I give you any operator in the field theory, you have to construct for me a dual observable in the string theory that corresponds to it, okay? So now let's motivate a little bit more geometrically the correspondence. Okay, so as I said before, the way you should think about this is the following. So you have this cylinder, you have this string theory living in the bulk. Now, in the bulk, you can have anything that you want can happen. You can have the most violent fluctuations that you can imagine. The only requirement is that the geometry at the boundary of the cylinder is fixed. The walls of the cylinder are rigid, but you can fluctuate as much as you want inside the cylinder. That's a statement that we're looking at asymptotically until the sitter 5 times is 5. Means that only very very close to the boundary do we approach a fixed geometry, which is the integer 5. In the interior, it can be arbitrarily complicated geometry. Okay. And the dual gauge theory, n equals 4 squaring mils, lives in a theory. So ADS5 is a theory that lives in 5 dimensions. N equals 4 squaring mils is a theory that lives in 4 dimensions. So squaring mils lives in this boundary of the cylinder. Okay? So now let me tell you why you might think, why am I talking about cylinders? But now let's see how this is exactly the geometry or the Penrose diagram of ADS space. And how ADS space has a very particular type of boundary, a time-like boundary, that can accommodate a field theory living on it. Okay? So the phi sphere I already described. You can always embed the phi sphere in R6. ADS5 can also be described as a hyperboloid. In R2,4. Remember that the phi sphere was a sphere, but in R6. ADS5, Lorentzian ADS5, is a hyperboloid in R2,4. And it can be described by an equation very similar to the sphere, but it has negative curvature, so it means that you have to have some negative signs. And L is the curvature radius of the ADS space. Okay? This is the analog of the radius of the sphere for the sphere. Except that for anti de Sitter space is a non-compact space, but we still can assign to the non-compact space a radius of curvature, which is defined exactly by this embedding equation. So now let's put some coordinates. If this was a sphere, you would know how to try to find coordinates. You just have to find parameterization of this equation in terms of angles. Okay? Let me give you a useful parameterization of anti de Sitter space by writing it like this. Essentially, I want to find solutions of this equation. And in order to write down the metric, what you do is, OK, so do you know how to write metrics in embedded surfaces? So what you can do is you start with this space, which has this metric, right? Now I solve this equation by finding the embedding coordinates, which let me choose this embedding coordinate. We'll see that this is obviously a solution. So I'll take L cos rho times e to the I tau. I guess I want an I here. And then for these other ones, I want to make manifest a three sphere. So there is an SO4 symmetry rotating these four coordinates, right? Is that obvious? I mean, the sum of these squares is the left invariant if I perform an SO rotation that rotates 1, 2, and 3, 4. So that means that I can make manifest. I'm going to try to construct a three sphere out of that. So I can write this as xi equals L sin rho and I, where I goes from 1, 2, 3, and 4. And in order for us to solve this equation, I have to impose that the sum from 1 to 4 of these NIs is 1. So that these NIs parameterize a unit three sphere. So it's now completely straightforward to just plug in this embedding here, and you see that you identically satisfy the equation using the deep fact that cos square minus sin square is 1, okay? And using this fact, of course. So now, in order to compute the metric, all that you have to do is compute the differentials here, okay? And what you get is the metric of ADS space. So you get, for this particular parameterization, just like there are many ways of writing a metric on a sphere, there are many ways of writing the metric on anti de Sitter space, but this is a useful set of coordinates. So this is a particular parameterization of the metric of ADS 3 times S3. We have kind of a radial coordinate in this geometry, rho. And you notice that for fixed rho, if I fix the metric at fixed rho, the slice that you get is r, I mean this tau, this t, you should think of it as a time coordinate, times a three sphere. So essentially what you're making a space by foliating r times S3 over this coordinate rho. Yes? I mean, question. Yes, thank you. OK. So can anyone tell me what the topology of anti de Sitter space is by looking at the form of the matrix?
Yes.
The
topology shouldn't depend on the metric.
ADS yes, I know.
So it's as the topology embedded in R.
Well, it has the topology, it has trivial topology. That's what I want. It has trivial topology.
What is the trivial topology?
Just R5. Yeah. The thing I wanted to stress out here is that even though you have three spheres, you have a three sphere here. This three sphere is topologically trivial because it shrinks at rho equals 0. Yeah.
So if I believe it's topologically, it's the same as a cylinder, right?
Well, so, okay. So something I skipped over is that what we're doing actually is not looking at the hyperboloid, but the universal property of the hyperboloid. If you don't know what that means, don't worry. But the point is that tau, if you really want to cover the hyperboloid, tau has to have periodicity 2 pi in order that x, this coordinate runs from minus infinity to infinity. But you can try to just let extend it so that tau goes from minus infinity to infinity. So in ADS50, we're always talking about this metric where tau goes from minus infinity to infinity. OK. So now let's try to connect this metric to this picture. Maybe you can have it here. Actually, what I want to do now is this coordinate rho, by the way, is a radial coordinate that goes from 0 to infinity. Okay? And what I want to do is, in order to visualize the space, I want to bring, and there is a boundary at infinity, okay? If I take rho going to infinity, then the whole metric, this factor of the metric, and this factor of the metric blows up. So as rho goes to infinity, the metric blows up as 2 to the rho, I guess over 4, times minus dt squared plus d omega 3 squared. The omega 3. This is the, okay, by the way, this is the metric on the unit 3 square. And this is exactly the boundary of the space. Intuitively, the boundary of the space is the location where distances are infinitely far away. And this is exactly what's happening here because this factor is blowing up. So this is the definition of what's called the boundary or the conformal boundary of this space. But in order to make the, I don't know how to visualize infinity, one thing we can try to do is to rescale things in such a way that the boundary is in a coordinate of finite range. So we're going to get the cylinder. So what you can do is just do a trivial rewriting of the metric like this. So I'm just factoring out a factor of cos squared, right, from the metric. So I have to put it back here and put it back here. And now I change coordinates to, I declare that the tangent of theta is sinus rho. This implies that d theta equals d rho cos rho. So that this metric can be written as the metric of the anti-de-Sitter space can be written as L squared over the cosine square of theta minus dt squared plus d theta squared plus sine squared theta d omega 3. Okay. So what's the range of theta in this metric? Given that rho was from 0 to infinity, and this is the change of coordinates, what's the range of theta? 0 to pi over 2. So what we have accomplished by that is to bring the boundary at a finite distance. Because notice now that the location where the metric blows up, which is the definition of the conformal boundary, is precisely pi over 2, where this factor blows up. Okay. So then we immediately now can map to this picture. So what's this picture of anti-de-Sitter space? This is called the Penrose diagram of anti-de-Sitter space. So we have time. We have something like a radial coordinate of finite range, and then we have a three sphere. So you should think of this side of the cylinder as time. You should think of the radial coordinate of the cylinder being a theta. So you here you are at theta equals 0, kind of at the center of the space. And the boundary is at theta equals pi over 2. Okay. And okay, and every circle here, every cross section here is a three sphere. So that's hard to imagine, maybe, but imagine we drew the metric not of ADS5, but of ADS3. then this literally would be a circle. Okay. So that's the picture of anti-de Sitter space. It's a box of conformally of finite size where time goes up the cylinder. Notice that the metric at the boundary, if I look at the metric at the boundary, the part that survives, which is this, right? When I go to the boundary, I have to fix theta to equals pi over 2. So that means that the metric at the boundary here is the metric of, well, it's minus dt squared plus d omega 3, which is the metric of r times s3, okay? In this picture of the duality, this is where the geometry in which the field theory is going to live. So the gauge theory lives here at the boundary. So we're going to study n equals 4 super young Mills on r times s3, where r is time. And remember that r times s3, in the tutorial yesterday, we know that it's related by a conformal transformation to the more familiar way that we write n equals 4 to n equals 4 super young Mills on Minkowski space. Okay. So very naturally, the anti-de Sitter geometry gives you a metric at the boundary of the space where you can study n equals 4 super young Mills. Okay, so let me some other cool properties of EDS. Oh, well, I erased it, but so from the embedding that I wrote down, let me write it again. What are the symmetries? So if you look at the embedding of a sphere, you represent a sphere by embedding it in Rn, you can immediately resolve the symmetries of that space. We can do exactly the same thing here. So from this, can you read off what the obvious symmetry of this space is, of this embedding is? SO24, yes, because you have, essentially what you have is something like, if you want to think in terms of vectors, six-dimensional vectors from minus 1 to 4, you have x tau times eta times x equals eta, where eta is minus, minus, plus, 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 plus. And this is exactly the definition of SO2.4, okay? And it's not a coincidence that this is exactly the conformal group of the theory that lives at the boundary. So what you have is that the isometries of ADS5 match the conformal symmetry of the theory at the boundary, which is n equals 4 super young Mills. And actually, as we will see perhaps in the second lecture, in fact, the isometries, so you have this metric that lives inside the cylinder. If you ask what is the effect of an isometry in the bulk of the cylinder, how does it act on the boundary? It acts precisely as conformal transformations. So an isometry really corresponds, once it's pushed to the boundary, to the way a conformal transformation would act on the four-dimensional field theory on the boundary. So that's very nice. As I said, the boundary is r times s3. It's kind of a cylinder. And this is time-like. So you have time flowing up the cylinder. Now, some intuition about the geometry of this space. Let's look at the geodesics, just to get a feeling of what different particles like to do in anti-de Sitter space. The most shocking property about anti-de Sitter space is that even though the metric, the proper distance from the center of the space to infinity, to the boundary, is infinity, If you take a light ray and you shoot it at the boundary, it will, okay. This is supposed to be 45 degrees. It will come back to you in a finite amount of time. This is completely different than in flat space. If you shoot something at infinity, you're going to die before it comes back. Here, it comes after a finite amount of time. And this is a very peculiar property of this space, essentially. It's one of the characterizing features of this space. Remember that time is flowing like this. So this is for massless particles. If you have a massive particle, this is proper time. So the way you can see it is that look at the metric, the coordinate time. I mean, look at the metric that has radial motion. And all geodesics satisfy the square equals zero. So it means that you have to solve minus cos square dt square plus the rho square equals zero. And if you integrate this, so t is the integral from zero to infinity of the rho over cos rho is finite. If we look at a massive particle instead, and we start near the center with some initial radial velocity that wants to go to the boundary, so we shoot it with a gun to the boundary, no matter how hard you shoot it, it always gets trapped in the interior of ADS space. So essentially, a massive particle, oscillate around the center of ADS space. The reason that this happens is also kind of pretty clear from the, if you write down the equation for a massive geodesic in anti-de-Sitter space, what you will find is that it sits in a gravitational potential. It's like a particle in a box. So it's going back and forth as it's hitting the two turning points of the box. So this is two basic properties. This highlights that signals can reach the boundary in finite amount of time. This signals the fact that if you have something heavy, it likes to fall at the center because there's a gravitational potential that likes to attract things at the center of anti-de-Sitter space. Okay, so something that's unusual about anti-de-Sitter space that in fact confused people for many years, if not decades, is precisely this very strange fact that signals reach the boundary in a finite amount of time. This suggests that what's called the Cauchy problem, which is the problem where you say, I start at some initial time, and I want to know the evolution of the system at any arbitrary time. In anti-de-Sitter space, this is not really well defined unless you specify boundary conditions. And physically, that's very clear, because if I shoot here something, unless I specify a boundary condition here, namely, whether there is a mirror here or I make a hole here, one second, I cannot determine the later propagation. So the time evolution in anti-de-Sitter space is only uniquely determined if you specify boundary conditions for all time at the boundary, essentially. And we will see that this fits perfectly with the prescription of how to compute correlators in the boundary field theory using ADS. Yes, another question?
See how a light pulse through to infinity in a finite amount of time, but I don't see why you say it will come back.
Well, you have to specify the boundary condition. You could have things leaking in from the boundary, you could have things going out of the boundary. That's the statement. You have to tell me what's happening at the boundary.
Okay.
And that's exactly what ADS, what the conformal field theory is going to tell you. It's going to tell you what's happening out there. What boundary condition should all fields satisfy at the boundary of the Sitter space? And we'll see that the boundary condition has an annual interpretation in the CFT as being the source for the operators. Okay. Let me see. Maybe I should start this. So now that we have a pretty good intuition about ADS, hopefully, let me make the, let me write for you what the proposal is of how you compute the correlation functions. Remember that here I have a boundary field theory, right? And at the boundary, I can have observables. And remember that I wrote down a certain number of local operators. I can consider various local operators here, OX1, OX2, and so on, OX3. In field theory, we're usually interested in the Green's functions. What we want to compute is the correlation functions of gauge invariant operators. For the time being, let's focus on the local gauge invariant operators. So the zeroth order question that you have to ask, well, the zeroth order question is the one I already wrote, that for every bulk field, for every boundary operator, you have to write down a corresponding bulk field that corresponds to it. But now imagine you want to calculate something. You want to calculate things like this. So in the conformal field theory. So I'll write the proposal and then I'll stop, essentially make a couple of comments and stop. So we want to ask, how would I compute this observable in the boundary conformal field theory using anti-de Sitter, the bulk string theory in anti-de Sitter? And this is the proposal that was put forward, how to do it, by Gapser, Klebanov, Polyakov, and Witten, which says that if you look at the generating functional of all possible local operators. So this O, you list all possible operators in your theory. This phi zero is a source. So I'm sure you've seen this in the lecture, that you can add an operator to the Lagrangian by coupling it to some source, and then you can kind of bring down the operator by differentiating this object with respect to the source. So this would be the generating functional in principle of all connected, like I can write it as like that, is a functional of phi naught. Is the generating functional of all connected correlation functions in the conformal field theory. Any particular correlation function can be obtained by suitably differentiating phi zero and then evaluating it at phi zero equals zero. So if I do it once, I just get the expectation value of x. If I do it twice, I get the two-point function and so on. And this is, we're talking about the conformal field theory. The statement is the following. What they say is that once you specify boundary sources, so these phis are boundary sources for the operator, this is computed by evaluating the bulk partition function. So for the time being, have in mind that we're computing something in the gravity approximation. We have Einstein gravity here in the bulk with possible string and alpha prime and L Planck corrections. You have to evaluate the bulk partition function. Essentially, you have to solve a Dirichlet problem. So you say that you have to solve the bulk equations of motion with fixed boundary conditions. Okay, so that more practically, what it tells you that remember that I said that for every operator, there was a corresponding bulk field, phi. Notice that I'm putting one extra coordinate because this phi field lives in the bulk of the box. So I have to specify the location in the boundary coordinate, but also the location at where this field is in the AVS, in the radial direction. And what it says is that you have to solve the path integral with the following boundary condition, with the boundary condition that the bulk field dual to this operator approaches as it approaches the boundary, which is at z equals zero in this coordinate, okay? So you think of, you know, z equals zero is gonna be the parameterization of the boundary, approaches phi naught of x, okay? So the rule is solve the bulk equations of motion of gravity or supergravity, or in string theory if you know how to do it. with a specified boundary condition that all fields at infinity go to this phi naught, which in the gauge theory language has interpretation of a source. Okay. So this object is very hard to compute in general, but we can compute it in a particular approximation. But maybe I should do that in the second lecture. I'll start the second lecture with kind of making explicit this correspondence in the semi-classical limit where the bulk theory is described by Einstein gravity. Okay. Any questions about this? You should have questions, but okay, let's postpone maybe to the second part.
When's the second lecture?
Where?
When is it? Right now?
145?
145.
Today is the second lecture, 145?
Yes.
Oh.
Well, yeah, for me.
Great. I didn't get an extra lecture to make up for Monday.
Oh, you're not even taking some work.